Def Leppard, in case you don't know. I'm not sure how you could not know who Def Leppard is, but it's called Hysteria. Yesterday, for anybody who was paying attention, was the 40th anniversary of American hostages being taken in Iran. And whenever I see stories about that, I think about Jeff Kenney, who was there before that happened.
Come in, bro.
So Jeff is going to join us right now, very graciously. I can hear you.
Okay.
And so... Jeff, first of all, how you doing? You're not appearing with Tim Lynch, so this will be a lot less stress for you. And
I miss him already.
you don't have to compete with Timmy intellectually, so that's got to take a lot of pressure off you. So all you got to do is be yourself.
He walked right over me.
First of all, I'm sure you saw that anniversary, and it's something that you know, that is close to your life, your life experience. So, let's talk about what rank were you, how did you get screened and sent to Iran as a pretty junior Marine?
Yeah, well, I was 19 years old. I'd been in the Marine Corps for about 14 months when I got to the school, which at that time was at Henderson Hall in Arlington, Virginia, for embassy school. And how I was screened was that even though the Marine Corps was at kind of a low time frame as far as quality of recruits and stuff, they still had a pretty high standard for Marine security guards. And you had to have above a 95 GT, I think. You had to be a high school grad, and you had to have no, you had to be able to have a top secret clearance. So that meant, you know, a dearth of police involvement. And so it was only me and one other guy in the whole base of 29 Palms were eligible. Not so much because of the brain stuff or the moral stuff, but in those days we still had a lot of guys who were in the Marine Corps on 2-year enlistments, and I was a 4-year and this other guy was a 4-year, so we still had plenty of time. And in some of my past ramblings I told you guys they sent some of us out there to wait for 1st Battalion 4th Marines to come back from Oki, and they didn't come back that year. They didn't come back, I don't think, till a year later. And so I was just there, I was like building tire targets for the new thing called CACs that the Marine Corps is coming up with, the Combined Arms Exercise. And so I was eager to do this. And when I went to school, they had a straw poll, kind of like you do in TBS for your MOS, for your job. And they said, you stand up, Kenny, in front of the whole class. You go, this lucky bastard is going to Bangkok, Thailand. And I said, I was such a dork. I go, is that a hardship post? No. And they start telling me all this stuff about the easy availability of sex there. I almost fainted. I was so excited, you know? Then when our actual orders came, mine said, AMM, as in American Embassy, Tehran, Iran. This is like 3 weeks later. So I'm like, perhaps this is another name for Bangkok, Thailand.
This is the code name.
And so, no, it wasn't. There had been an incident during the Marine Corps ball, which is just a couple weeks before, where a Marine was relieved, and he was sent back. And I actually met that guy before I went to Iran. I graduated from the school on the 9th of December. It was like about 2 months, 2.5 months school. And then I was on the road by the 11th of December. And I was in – I got to Tehran right around the 12th of December or so. And by that time, I had made corporal in the school.
So hold on. So first of all, what year is this?
1976.
The hostages get taken in 79, right?
Yes, this is before that.
Okay, so, and then you're posting there. Are they one-year posts, and then you go someplace else? Is that how MSG works? So it's 2 years total? And then one at a hardship, and then One at not so hard
30-month tour once you graduate the school.
Got it. And so explain to me again. So you get screened, right? But you had only been in the Marine Corps for 14 months?
Yeah. Most of us were real boots.
And that includes recruit training, right? The whole nine yards.
Yeah.
Holy shit, man.
I went on leave to go to the school at the end of August. And I'd been in the Marine Corps blazing 13 months at that point.
And what rank were you?
I was a Lance Smoothie, Lance Corporal. And I had a fucking high and tight and a pair of ill-fitting black birth control glasses that made me look like some kind of a small, misshapen version of Clark Kent.
So talk to us about what was MSG duty like?
Well, the school was heavily...
I'm at school. Because, one of the pictures, you know, when we were young... You know, it was always Marines in their dress blues at parade rests in Paris and London and far off posts, and right. Is one of the things the Marine Corps did, you know. And the Clayton Lone Tree thing hadn't happened yet. So so this was one of the things that Marines like, oh, they're, you know, we go. So you're a Lance, you're a junior Lance Smoothie, and you go and you go to MSG school. So what did you learn in school?
Well, we learned physical security, like basically security guard type stuff, how to control areas. You know, we learned about how cipher locks worked and stuff like that. We learned about the whole thing you learn later on about the difference between a confidential, secret, top secret, all that stuff. It was a high speed general order stuff. And the other half of the school was PT, a lot of PT, so you weren't a fat ass, you know. And and inspections, a lot of Blues inspections, a lot of Delta inspections, you know, Blue Delta inspections, a lot right. of. This is before we were allowed to have Corframs or anodized brass, so we spent a lot of time working on bullshit like that. And then a couple times
hey,
a week.
Let me tell you, if you never saw the art of spit shining in the Marine Corps, I mean, we did it on sea duty. And some of these guys are like, you know how, you know, if for whatever reason you get punished and have to go to a craft fair and you actually go and you see these guys like blowing glass or they're working on copper. Or they're doing something like this is the way these guys could do spit shining.
Yeah,
it was
amazing, guys. Like, you know, a guy would have a can of saddle soap, a can of black shoe polish, and then in one of the covers of the can had hot water, and the other one had cold water. And he'd have his little handkerchief wrapped around his finger, and he would get in there and he'd start working. And before you know it, you got this. You know, these guys are good. Now, I wasn't that guy. I was the guy who bribed that guy to do my boots.
But, I mean, they would do this shit, though. I mean, they would, I saw guys use, like, flames on it. You mentioned the guy had hot water. You got to get the wax down into all the crevices, you know, and that's how you got to fill them up. And then we'd, like... Dude, I don't even know what you're talking about. Okay, but you know, how much money do you want? How much money do you want to do mine? So I tell this story, but it's no bullshit. So you'd be standing in line on you know, as part of a Marine detachment, and these guys so Marines be standing there in their spit shines, and some sailor in his steel toe boot steps back and just crushes the toe. Right, of a spit shine boot.
That's a death penalty of death.
And they would do it. They would just drop him on the mess deck. And then they would get brought to you, like, what happened? Sir, there's a fight on the mess deck. What started? Sir, he stepped on my spit shines. I'm like, oh, motherfucker, sorry, man. That's grounds. Pay attention.
It was harder with the visor for the white cover, man. That's a bitch.
And again, most of the people listening only know it as a core fan, piece of core fan.
Well, then that's the thing that was incredible. In December, they let us do core fram stuff. So I went to the school, and it was a lot of like, and we had a fearsome instructor named Gunny Murray, who later he retired as a sergeant major. We had a silver star. He got the silver star for remember Reasoner got the Medal of Honor killed the company commander in 3rd Recon Battalion. Well, he was rescued. His already dead body was rescued by young Lance Corporal Murray. And that was this guy, huge guy from down south somewhere. And he's a fearsome. By that time, he had been a drone instructor. He had a silver star. He had a bronze star. He had like 8 inches of fucking ribbons on his chest. And, you know, he's terrifying, man.
Well, and let me tell you one more thing. They were ribbons earned against the North Vietnamese.
Yes.
Which were no bullshit ribbons. Right.
I wish I could have got you guys together because I didn't even know they had a connection. Sergeant Major Henry was the first sergeant of that outfit, and he hooked me back up with Murray. Murray ended up marrying a female Marine officer who ended up retiring as a colonel. Did you know that? Well, no, you didn't know him. Colonel Murray, and she was there in Quantico.
No.
So I met them all in what used to be the gold carpet area of TBS. 2001, man. It was kind of nice.
Wow. That's crazy. So,
I say something else.
Yeah.
That time it was going hot and heavy in Beirut, and the Marines there had a guy get wounded. And
Wait a minute. 1970 what in Beirut?
1976. The war was blazing there, and even though the guys in the consulate in Beirut took mortar fire, and one of them got wounded. He ended up going to Germany. Matter of fact, he was in Germany with me. I think they avoided the American diplomatic mission. The initial belligerents were fighting in Lebanon
right.
until the early 80s. And then when the PLO was they were a bacillus that was injected into Beirut because of 1970 in September, King Hussein threw them the fuck out of Jordan. Hence the name Black September. Had nothing to do with the Israelis. I mean, not, you know, tangentially it did, but, and they went to Lebanon, and that's what caused it. Just, there was a very delicate balance in Lebanon, and the injection of the PLO, you know, thousands of well-armed dudes who were pissed off, caused the whole destabilization and thing, and, you know, and then later on, you had a huge, minority of Shia people, who later became proxies of the Iranians, you know, that's years later. But at that time, that was going on, and they were starting to say that embassy duty is going to change to be more of a, an emergency personal protective thing, which we weren't really supposed to do.
Right.
As a matter of fact, the guy who wrote the book, A Rumor of War, and several other pretty good books, Phil Caputo,
I read it.
He was a journalist there in 76. He was, him and his photographer had just finished interviewing some fighters there, and they're walking down the thing, and some guy just shot him in the calves with an AK. And he went down. He ended up in this filthy, refugee hospital, and Lieutenant Colonel Braun was the company commander. The company command post for embassy duty, Bravo Company, was in Beirut at that time, and they got a couple of embassy vans, went to this place and pulled old Capito's bleeding ass out of there. And there's a story, a book he wrote called Del Corso's Gallery, where the hero was a photographer, combat photographer in Vietnam, and then he goes to Lebanon, and it's the story of that guy, but it's based on that.
Let's go back. All of a sudden, you cut to, I met this guy in Germany that had been wounded in. What the hell were you doing in What were you doing in Germany?
That's after my Iran tour.
Wow, you did pretty good. Let's talk about going to Iran. You get off the plane in Tehran. First of all, what's Tehran? You land in it. Is it hot, humid place? Is it a dry place, moderate place? You know, if you look on the map, it's surrounded by mountains. Is the city, is the city in the mountains? Explain Tehran to us.
Yes, it is. It's high up. It's as high as Denver. Almost exactly. It's a mile up. And when we got there, it was snowing.
Oh, cool.
And I flew in, and this is the only time in my life I sat next to a nice-looking girl in a from Frankfurt to Tehran. And her sister was married to an Iranian guy, and they lived in Shiraz. And so she was going to take a connector after a day or so. So I walked her out. No, this is before they had the thing where you get off the airplane, it's like a tunnel, and then you're in the terminal.
Right.
Oh, no. You had to walk down, and you're outside, right?
Right, down the steps. Like the president does these days, right?
Yes. And so we walked down, and we got in these, like, shuttle buses. They took us to the embassy, to the airport, Mirabad Airport, which was, you know, a couple hundred yards away. And holy Christ. It was packed with people, all of them screaming and hollering. It was like bedlam. And there was animals in the terminal. Like, there's camels in there. And so she's like, all of a sudden, this person comes up and says, you know, Susie or whatever her name was, her relatives got her, right? And they, you know, so they said hello and everything. And they left. And I'm like, where are that? I'm like, I'm starting to, I mean, I landed in Frankfurt and changed planes. And it was like a beautiful place, you know, the airport.
Right.
This place. And people are hollering, screaming and selling shit. And all of a sudden, here's these dudes with short fucking hair, and wearing, like, two of them wearing leisure suits, two of them wearing regular suits, and this gunny comes up, and the gunny got me, he goes, are you Corporal Kenny? Yes, I am. Come with us. And shoom, they got my ass out of there. Right through customs, everything, right? And in those days, you had an official passport, and you had a civilian passport. And so, I went to the embassy, I was, like, jet-lagged and shit, and it was fucking cold, though. I mean, it was mid-December, you know, 1976, and a little dusting of snow. But I have to tell you, it was a fascinating place. Within 2 or 3 days, I was totally into it.
Well, you grew up in Pennsylvania.
Connecticut.
Connecticut. You get your ass sent to fucking 29 Palms, and now you're going overseas. But you're a reader, right? I mean, you're intellectually, although you may not initially when you would have met him, you're a reader and an interested guy, and it doesn't surprise me one bit that in short order, you know, it got very, very interesting and I'm sure for you very fascinating.
Yeah, because I fucked up a couple of times and I didn't know anything about Iran except when they were Persia. Alexander the Great just fucking kicked their asses left, right, and center. So I said to this cab driver one time, I go, hey, man, where's Arbella? He goes, what's that? I go, Alexander the Great, like, destroyed the whole Persian army, you know? And he's just looking at me in the rearview mirror. I'm thinking, ooh. Now, you know, I was only 19. I mean, I didn't know what I fucking was doing. But, and the ambassador was Richard Helms.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
And now that guy met every, you know, we were talking a little bit of post-traumatic winning on this. It made me think of the guy. He met every Marine. He had an interview. I interviewed with the guy.
No shit.
And he's a fucking Yale guy, man. He's one of them guys like that movie, the Good Shepherd. And, he was interested in, like, what type of training, what's it like back there, and, you know, how's America doing? And, one of our posts, the compound was huge. It was about half as big as Del Mar, Camp Del Mar, you know,
right,
there in Camp Pendleton.
Right.
And his residence, we had a post in there at night, post 4, and you just sat there in the foyer of his house. Across the hallway was the sitting room, and he'd be in there with his wife. And he was in his last couple of weeks, because in January, they stayed all through Christmas, but in January they left. And he had to go up. He got charged with perjury because of Watergate.
Yeah, no, he had, Richard Helms, man. He's a big time guy in American history. You could look him up. So you know what I mean? That's a throwback to a bygone day, right? You know,
yeah. And one other thing about the guy, he had a library Mac, and his office was like a miniature dome. And it was one of those things that had those like ladders on wheels, so you could. And he goes, if you like to read books, you can take a book out of here. Just make sure you put it back when you're done with it. So I got this book out of there the first week called Khyber, you know, and it was about the history of the fighting around, basically a history of the Brits in Afghanistan and in Northwest, what they call the Northwest Frontier, the, you know, basically Pashtunistan, you know.
Right.
So yeah, it was interesting.
It's interesting, you know, I had you know, a woman came on who does kayakal training for the Marine Corps, and she talked about what Americans didn't understand was Iran had a free election in the 50s, and the Shah did not get elected, or the United States guy, and I can't remember who it was, but the United States, right, overturned the results of the election. And that simmered in Iran for years and years and years. And you had guys, you know, you had like Ayatollah Khomeini, you know, in exile, it's a really interesting interview, right? And her name, if you do a search on Mrs. Smith, we don't use her real name. But she goes through the history of Iran, and it's really interesting. And, you know, and so did you get any indication? Because, I mean, by all accounts, you know, when 4 years ago, yesterday, when that happens, you know, the tension brewing was like Americans were like, what's going on? The Shah was our friend. You know, Iran was our friend. So when you got there in 76, right?
Yeah.
Was there any sense of that that you perceived?
No. And although there was issues with the, you had about 2/3 of people were like wearing blue jeans and Western suits, and they had female traffic cops, unbelievable, you know, and girls wearing blue jeans, girls wearing miniskirts. Then about the other third, you had women in the chador, and you had these guys, the mullahs, right?
What's the chador? I mean, we know it as the burqa.
The burqa.
Yeah.
Now, I have to tell you, that Mossegeda guy was a commie, and I don't really agree with the fact, basically, the CIA overthrew the government using, you know, military officers, and the guy who engineered it was Theodore Roosevelt's grandson, Kip Roosevelt.
Wow, we love that.
Well, how I heard about it was Richard Helms told me. And it was open source stuff. It was no secret. I just was ignorant about that because, you know, I didn't know anything about, you know.
So you have Richard Helms looking at you saying, Lance Corporal Kenny, what do you know about the history of Iran? Nothing, sir. Let me tell you about it.
Well, he had been there several times before.
Wow.
He was personal friends with the Shah from when they were in their 30s, you know. So, and the other guy who was really personal friends with the Shah was Douglas MacArthur's nephew, Arthur MacArthur Jr., who was the ambassador before Richard Helms there.
Holy shit. Because let me tell you what's weird. Douglas MacArthur's son is named Arthur MacArthur, but he comes when he and his wife.
That's right, right. Douglas MacArthur is the guy who's the ambassador. You're absolutely right. They switched kids. Like, the kids switched, you know what I'm saying?
Right. And Douglas MacArthur's kid was a musician. He had grown up exclusively outside the United States, was not the guy that his father was. And when he came back to the United States, he essentially disappears. His mom and his dad live in, I think, the Waldorf Astoria or something like that. And the kid kind of just melts into,
right,
you know, and does not want any part of that. So it's interesting that his nephew, you know, rose to that station.
More like him than he looked like his dad. Because he came and visited while I was there.
Oh, and no shit?
The staff went nuts. They loved the guy. I mean, the Iranians who worked for the staff, you know? They loved both of them. They loved Richard Helms, and they loved MacArthur.
That is crazy. So you saw Douglas MacArthur?
I saw the kid.
Oh, the kid. Oh, I thought you said he came to visit.
No, the actual ambassador, Douglas MacArthur II, he came.
Oh, because I was going to say, that's a pretty good trick, because I think he died in the 60s.
Yeah, he died in the 60s. he died around the same time Winston Churchill did.
And men, like a good soldier, all just fade away, fade away, fade away. He addresses a joint session of Congress, right, and he was supposedly going to come back from Korea and run for president.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, if you, American Caesar, great book, Manchester.
It is a great book. I read it like 6 times.
Yeah. He memorized American Caesar. Recite page 342 on the bottom, no footnotes.
There's a quote in there, though, from, and this is William Manchester's goes, it's a shame that he didn't get along with the Marines because he was their type of general and they were his type of troops. Remember that?
Well, let me tell you, I mean, some of the great quotes about Marines. You know, what's that one from MacArthur? I've just been to the front and there is no finer fighting organization on the world than the United States Marines.
Yep.
Yeah.
Better than what Truman said, that's for sure.
The Marine Corps, you know, arguably MacArthur's greatest tactical feat is the landing at Incheon. It's his daring and him giving it the green light and the First Marine Division, baby, the Blue Diamond executes that son of a bitch. Wow.
They didn't want to. They wanted to land at the beach. You know?
No.
Basically, Donald Trump them. You know?
He's
like, I don't know.
No, I don't think so. We're going to do this. Okay, this guy's in charge, but he's fucking crazy. What was it like living in Tehran when you're, how old are you now? 19? 20?
19. Yeah, I was 19. Well, there's great guys there. We had like three or four guys who did a year in Oki, and then they went right to embassy duty. So we had we had two or three guys from 3rd Recon Battalion. We had a couple guys from 9th Marines and 4th Marines and stuff. And, the assistant NCIC was a sergeant who had been a machine gunner. And then we also had another sergeant who came in who was from 7th Marines when they were at Pendleton. And these were our A slashes, but our NCIC was.
Hold on. What are A slashes?
It's like assistant NCIC, kind of like the NCIC is a staff NCO, but the assistant NCIC is a senior sergeant.
Got it.
And it was a great bunch. We became like brothers, like in that we were fighting. Like when I retired, Mac, at my retirement ceremony, this guy who was a comm guy, who I got to know in the embassy, he kind of said, hey, can I come to your retirement? I'm like, fuck yeah. So he comes, he's telling stories to my mom and everybody. He's like, yeah, I can't remember if it was Jeff, but I had these three Marines at my house, and we were playing darts, and they were drinking. And there's like an argument, and one Marine threw a dart into the other Marine's head. And, they pulled that dart out of his head, and then they bandaged him up, and then they kept playing. I said to my buddy, who I'm still friends with, you know, who I keep in contact with almost weekly, and, hey, Mike, do you remember this thing about a guy getting a dart in his head? He goes, that happened every week. Don't you remember? So we weren't like, we were kind of, it was a, you know, we were 70s Marines, you know what I mean? But we were better in that we weren't overtly drug pushing
if the Marine Corps that I joined was a pretty hard organization. It was a hard drinking, and when you were overseas, you know, it was, involvement with prostitutes on liberty, hard drinking. But when you went to work, it was a hard place too. It wasn't, you know, like you could be drunk, right, every night. But if you got up and worked, nobody gave a shit. Right?
Yeah, it's your business.
Right, it was your business, and it was a hard drinking, hard fighting organization, and you were expected, you know, and fighting was, you know, fighting and alcohol were both, you know, part of the way of the Marine Corps, and that's what attracted guys to it. And so to hear somebody got a dart put in their head when they were, you know, in off duty hours when they were drinking, you know, that conversation sounds like this. What happened to your head? Nothing, sir. Where'd you get the Band-Aid? I walked into something last night, right? And then you hear the story later. Somebody drilled him with a dart and blah, 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 blah. So again, go back to the environment. And so you're there from 76 to 77. And so,
I left in February 78. I was there like 15 months.
Wow. So you leave about almost 2 years before this thing happens. But
yeah.
So give us your now throughout the course of your time there, did you see this thing beginning to percolate? Were you guys concerned? Okay. Talk about that.
It started getting tense around August, September of 77. Now at that time, Jimmy Carter had was president, and the Iranians the Shah was getting a lot of pressure to become more liberal. And the truth is, in some ways, he was already that way. He was pushing for more and more, voting for women. That happened. And although, who are you going to vote for? He's the king. You know what I mean? But, for lower jobs. And then he really was trying to modernize. He certainly was trying to modernize the military. You know, we were pumping as far as dating went, I don't think I ever dated an Iranian girl at that time, because it was full of British people and Americans, and it was like, and they'd all come to the embassy because it was like, civilized, and you could get a cheap drink there. It's a Marine house. And you had Bell Helicopter, you had the British Tank Building Company, MTS, you had a bunch of stuff. And up the road from us, in the northern part of Tehran, was a Army Air Force advisory base that we used to go to for liberty. You know, the Marines there, we had an ID card that said we were embassy officers, and then so we could go to the enlisted club and the officer club, and we did. And we got thrown out of both at different times.
That's awesome.
But never, went anywhere. You know, never went anywhere. I remember one time I had this buddy of mine named Salty. His name was Manny Saltero from East L.A. And he's like 5'3", tough Mexican kid, 0331. And we're in line waiting for drinks, waiting for our 45-cent gin and tonic, right? And we're in line, and this guy, this Army staff sergeant, says, he said something racist about Mexicans. You know, I think the guy's half in the back. So he turns around. So I'm like, so I spit on his neck, right? And then we have a fight. I win. But he's a staff sergeant, right? So they put me in this, like, brig they had up there, and the gunny came and got me out. And he made me stay on base, on the embassy for a month, which was fine with me because, you know, we had parties every week, so. it was kind of wild.
So for people that aren't familiar with the parties, the MSG parties that get thrown at the embassy, those things are legendary.
Yeah.
Talk about that. What was that like as a 19-year-old kid?
Well, we were right by the swimming pool, and it was like a four-story building, but it was on its last legs. So, and the bottom floor was the bar, and there next to it was like this prison gym type thing we had, you know? Inside the Marine house, they're talking about building another one, everything, because it was starting to fall apart. Like one time, we're in the kitchen, we're bullshitting, and all of a sudden, the ceiling caves in a little bit, and there's feet there hanging, dangling. It's the guy who was brushing his teeth in the head, and the floor gave way, and he's hanging on to the sink with his toothbrush in his mouth, and his feet hanging into the thing. So they're like, eventually they had to move us out of there to these transit apartments that are right next door to it. But it was great. We loved it. And like the way the rooms were, the wall only went up to like a foot from the ceiling. So, you know what I mean? So it was almost more like a cube you're in than your room, you know?
Right.
But I'll tell you what, it was the best year of my life, bar none, to this year. It pisses my wife off. What about the year when the kids were? I go, that was more of a pain in the ass than I'm letting on. I go, but that was... I was in great shape. I had no worries because I was too stupid to have worries. And I was only 19, 20. I turned 20 over there. And it was just great. And, like, you could go around the corner and you'd see all these Centurion tanks that the Iranians were driving down the road going to do some exercise somewhere.
Yeah, made by the Brits, right?
Jets flying overhead. And you around the corner and there's a caravan of camels coming from, from Afghanistan or something. Bringing shit, to sell. For me, it was super stimulating, because like you said, I was a reader. I was into the history of stuff and, every day. And I met people there. Like, I met famous people there. Like, we had a congressional delegation come, and this fucking old dude comes walking up to the post one. I'm on post one in my blues, and he goes, "Where are you from, Moraine?" It's Jacob Javits, Senator Javits from New York. "Sir, I'm from Connecticut." "Well, say hello to your senator." And there's Abraham Ribicoff, right? So he got this guy, his aide, taking notes of what I'm saying and shit. And they sent a letter to my mom. And then we met. I'm in there one another time. I'm coming off duty, and who comes in from the gatehouse is where, like, when you see the riots and everything, Death to America, that's like the motor pool gate where the gatehouse was. When people came to the embassy, they go there, they kind of get screened, and they come up to this garden to where the chancellery is, you know, about like a 100-yard journey. And in walks Anthony Quinn, Michael Sarrazin, and Jennifer O'Neill. And they were making a movie in Iran about from the James Michener book called Caravans.
Jennifer O'Neill?
Yeah.
Wow. Like, screw Anthony Quinn, man. Jennifer O'Neill, man. What movie was she in? Do I remember her from?
I think she was in
Summer 42.
Yeah, but she was in, and I looked for this movie. It's hard to get. I don't think it really.
I never even saw the Summer 42 except a clip of Jennifer O'Neill when I think her shirt like partially comes off. Some shit. Like
I didn't
that.
Either. I saw the Mad Magazine version, which is funny. And she goes. You hear her voice says off camera in the cartoon, "How you doing in there? This is great." You see him jumping around the bed. You see his legs sticking out of here, his elbows sticking out. She goes, "You think it's great now? Wait till I get in there with you." Yeah. So anyway, so and let me tell you about that guy Anthony Quinn. When that guy laughs, you got to laugh. You know what I mean?
Oh, he's got a huge laugh, right?
Yeah, and he's fucking talking to everybody, and he's having a blast. And then they made another movie there where they actually used the embassy, and they were going to use me and my buddy, but we were too stupid looking, like we had glasses and shit. So they used 2 6-footers, you know, instead. But, yeah, and this one had Peter Graves, and it was about this missile that gets stolen by a terrorist group.
And, why were they filming in Iran if they could just build a sound stage back in the day, right?
I don't know, man.
I don't know.
But the guy left us a VHS, like a prototype VHS,
yeah.
And a couple of movies that we were. It was huge, you know. This is 77. Yeah, it was a great time. But I have to tell you, we're there and we're watching the TV. We're watching the news, like delayed a couple days, right?
Right.
And it's a film clip of the Marines and we talked about this before. There's a demonstration there on the mall. All these Iranians wearing bags over their heads, and the Shah's visiting, and they have like an honor guard, like a parade form.
Yep.
And the demonstrators come and they put out tear gas, and the tear gas blows back across the honor guards, and they all break ranks except for 8-9. Stand there, snot rolling out their nose and stuff. Well, then that was like October, November, and then the Shah came to Iran. I think he had fucked up somehow. He made speeches about. We weren't going to back up any more dictators and stuff.
Right.
You know, and, but the Shah's like, hey, man, you know, the reason your buddies overthrew this thing, not because they like me, but because they didn't want Iran to end up like another Poland or East Germany, you know? And, they didn't do it just because they liked to be in charge in Iran. They did it because they were, Soviet Union borders Iran up there up in the north, you know? And, so, you know, during that time, we had huge riots, and they came at the embassy, and we were up decked out in our shit, but they never closed with us,
right.
Because the Iranian army just blew them off the street.
Right. Where were you 40 years ago yesterday? Where were you? I mean, you obviously watched it.
I was on the rifle range over by Margarita. I was in 3-5.
Get the fuck out.
No, I was, we were getting ready to. 3-5 is going over in February on the third UDP in history. And the 5th Marines did all UDPs at first, for the first year. And 1-5 went and 2-9 came back. And 2-5 went, I can't remember who came back. But then we went. We left in February of 80. So this was November of fucking 79. And we're in there. We're blackening our sights, you know,
right.
Around that, you know, that smudge pot they had. And
yep.
Somebody goes, hey, man, the fucking embassy in Iran got taken. Yeah, I guess you, and my guys, of course, give me shit. Yeah, the fucking pussy embassy guys couldn't hold them up. You know, and all this shit. And I'm like, well, what are you talking about? And then I got to watch the news. That was the first day of this shit. It was a gut wrencher for me, man, because I recognized all the places. I even knew a couple of the guys. Like, I met Jimmy Lopez. I knew Steve Curley, although I didn't know him then, really, you know, but I met him later, and, you know, because our NCIC we had when I was there, he's the reason I stayed in the Marine Corps. He had been in 1-5 in Vietnam, and then he was in 1-3 in Vietnam. He had, like, a shitload of Vietnam time, Purple Heart, Silver Star. He was in the rescue force to get Jimmy Howard off that hill when he got the Medal of Honor. And he had us drilling our ass off, you know, to react drills, to react to this, react to that, you know, attack on the embassy here, attack on the embassy there. It was really good tactical training. And he taught us to do calls of fire. He taught us a bunch of shit that you wouldn't learn. You know, he was a true Marine staff NCO. And he'd punch you in the stomach if you stepped out of line.
Hear that the way staff NCOs would be, and I heard General Zinni when I had him on to talk about discipline. He talked when he reported to his first platoon. I can't remember who it was with. He talked about his staff NCO sat him down and said, "Okay, Lieutenant, this is how it works." Okay, and he explained it to him, and he said, "I will keep you informed of everything, right, that goes on with this platoon. My job is to have this platoon ready so that you can command it, and we'll train it together, and then my job is to teach you and make you into a good officer too, because your training, you know, here, you know, is a lot of on the job training, and I take that very seriously. And you and I are a team, and that'll be the way it works." And I heard him saying that, and I was like, damn, man, that's not how my first platoon was. You know, getting information from my guy was like pulling, you know, molars, and it seemed like he liked that, right? He seemed like, and so there were guys in the Marine Corps that really didn't know how to do it. And in my opinion, that were throwbacks to, you know, staff NCOs when, you know, they did view their officers. I mean, they were young, but it was their job to train them. And the way you did it was keep them informed and you treat them with respect, and then you grow them to be good leaders. And I heard that with Zinni, and the guy you're talking about sounds exactly of the same cloth.
His name was Rodney Lee Stepp, and he's near the end of my time in Iran. He gave me a 6-5. Had all writing all over. He goes, "This is my 6-5. He goes, "You get in
the hold on. Well, tell everybody. Hey, tell everybody what the 6-5 is.
It's Squad Leader's Handbook. It's a Marine Corps publication. And so he said, when you get to the grunts, you should try for Super Squad. You probably won't win, but it's the best training there is. So I have to tell you, that he's how I got to 3-5. When I reenlisted, I said, he goes, he calls me in Germany, and he says, or no, I called him. He goes, "What's up?" You know, I hadn't talked to him. I put him up a little bit when he rotated out. I was in Germany, and he was going home. And so he came through Germany. You know, we went out, we had some drinks and shit, you know, he chased a couple women, because he was single too, you know. And he says to me, he gets back there, and I reenlist, and I said, "Hey, Gunny, I reenlisted, and I got orders for 1st Marine Division." He goes, "You dumbass." He goes, "You want to come to 3-5? I go, "Yeah." And he was my company Gunny.
Wow.
When I got there, he picked me up at the bus station from the airport, you know, from LAX. I drove down the bus to Oceanside. And he picked me up in a Corvette. I had to hang on to my shit because there's no back seat. And we went to his house. He lived in that high rise right near Del Mar, on the bottom deck, you know.
Right.
Overnight, watched San Ziwa Jima that night with that regular TV, just providential. Then he took me to division, and he told him, "This guy's going to V-35. "Well, Gunny, we need people in 2-5. He goes, "You don't understand." He just bogarted the corporal. And my orders for, and I went to fucking 3-5, man, and that's where I was.
Wow.
And he was my, I'll tell you another little libo story. I'm drunk in the embassy, in the bar, right? And
at the embassy in Tehran.
Yes. I'm 19, and he goes, it's like June of 1977. And he goes, "Corporal Kenny, you're drunk and you're making an ass of yourself. Go to bed." So I'm like, "Ah, fuck." So I go, "Wait a minute, Gunny. you know how when you're drunk, you don't think straight? I go, wait a minute, aren't we on Libo now? He goes, I suppose. I go, well, that means you can't tell me what to do. So go fuck yourself. I'll kick your ass. He goes, you will. Everybody's there with their mouths open. And this is one of those, like, blackout type drugs, you know? I don't remember too much of it. So we go out to the little patio, and I'm fucking getting my shit hot, you know? And he always wore cowboy boots and black slacks and, like, a sports coat, an open shirt.
Right.
He kicks me in the balls with the cowboy boots. About, not real hard, but enough that he goes, ooh, and bend over. Then he pulls my shirt over my head and pushes me over some lawn chairs. So I'm laying there throwing up, and he goes, hey, Corporal Kenny, I don't know if I can stand much more of this ass whipping. What do you say, Paul, draw? So they took me upstairs, and I never did that again.
That is hilarious.
But just like the great men like General Neller and, you know, who else is like that? General Neller and you know, Drew Watson. You can argue with them and have shit like that. They don't hold it against you.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right. No, I mean, but that was the Marine Corps. I mean, it was a rough and tumble place. And like I said, and, you know, you got up and you went to work. And if you were, you know, if you were a good guy and you worked hard, they didn't, you know, no bygones are bygones. It was, hey, this is a tough place, man. Kenny's all right. He's all right. Yeah. When he gets drunk, he does stupid shit. But you could beat his ass when he's drunk, right?
Yeah.
Just make sure he's really drunk.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. So 40 years later.
He said we were going to get attacked there, though, Mac.
He did.
While we were there doing all those drills, he said, I feel this coming. He goes, you know, I feel this. I talked to my buddies during the MC in Saigon during Tet. This is the type of shit. He goes, I just feel it. And plus he had briefings that we didn't get, you know?
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah, I was...
So 40 years later, what goes through your head when on a day like today?
Well, you know, I think about those times you were talking about. You know, I mean, I think I wish they had attacked while we were there, so we could have mowed them down. But then I think, you know, it would have been my Marine career and my life might have ended right then. You know,
right.
But. You know, I think about the guys who I was with there. Some of them I'm still in contact with. And, you know, and it was just, it was something. And then I met and talked to, like, I went to TBS. Curtly was, like, in the class behind me. I was in Fox Company, and he was in golf, I think, you know. And so I remember me and him and our wives and his wife and another couple of guys who were, you know, MESEPs. We were out there at Lunga Lake having a picnic.
Hey, it's Lunga Reservoir, jackass.
Hey, whatever. Well, Lunga Reservoir, and then...
What do you mean? You've only served there for about 7 years, for crying out loud.
You got to ask Dave Furness, and believe me, he'll call it Lunga Lake, too, because we ran into a couple guys when we were doing the... You know how when you'd be at IOC and the lieutenants would be... It's like 2:30 in the morning, and we're going to go get coffee because lieutenants are mostly down for the night, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, yes.
So we go either the Samskis or the R711, whichever was closer, and get coffee because it was open all night. And we're in there, and this black dude, old black dude, goes, "Are you guys on night maneuvers?" Because we're all camping up and shit, right? And we go, "Well, we're kind of going, yeah, you probably out there by Lunga Lake, right? I go there, I go fishing and shit." And me and Dave and this guy had a talk for about 20 minutes. It's pretty good. And Dave will say that exact thing, Lunga Lake.
I'll ask him. He's a general, though. He may not. He may call it Lunga Reservoir, which is which is named after the reservoir on Guadalcanal, for those
yes,
of you.
Yeah. After, you're right.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Lunga Lake does not fucking exist. Lunga Reservoir does. No, it's just a piece of history, and you know, I thought, you know, when I was watching a little bit of it today, and I thought, you know what, I need to get Jeff on and get his thoughts about it. So, and again, I'm in Minnesota speaking, and in fact, we're recording this, so I'm headed over there now. And so Jeff, I sent Jeff a text, and on short notice, he hopped out of what he was doing and to do this. So, I really appreciate it, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Hey, I love doing it. Thank you.
No. All right, more of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.